Okay, that was it. That was only 10 minutes. So, okay. What we're talking about tonight, subject, the rabbi made me do it. And what we're really talking about is, as you know, maybe you don't know, but you will find out in a few seconds, right, which is that most of Judaism is actually not written in the five books of Moses. I was once lecturing down in Fort Worth, Texas, at a Reformed temple, and a fellow kept asking me about, Rabbi, the Bible says this, the Bible says that. And he's got a strange accent. And I said, it's not really that relevant to ask me about the Bible, because I am an Orthodox rabbi, and we don't believe in the Bible. He said, oh. He said, what do you mean you don't believe in the Bible? He says, this is the Bible Belt. This is not just the Bible, this is the buckle of the Bible Belt. So I said, when you think about Bible, you know what you think of? The literal Christian fundamentalist translation of the five books of Moses. To you, that's the Bible. I believe in the Torah. The Torah is much, much more than the Bible. The Torah is the five books of Moses, the prophets and the writings in the original Hebrew, with the Midrash, the Sifri, the Sifra, the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Gemara, the Zohar, all the vast bulk of the Torah Shebaal Peh. What you see of the Torah in the five books of Moses is only the tip of the iceberg of Judaism, and the vast majority of it is actually beneath the surface. And in fact, if you look at the vast majority of what we do, it is based on what we call the Masorah, the oral tradition, Torah Shebaal Peh, not written explicitly. And I'd like to address three basic questions regarding this tonight. Three basic questions. Question number one, why do we need an oral tradition? Why don't we just do what they do on Sunday morning television? Open the Bible, right? Read what it says and do it, right? I mean, why do the rabbis have to complicate things, right? Why can't we just, right, look at the Bible and do what it says? That should be fairly simple. Why do we need an oral tradition? That's question number one. Question number two, is there any advantage to an oral transmission? Is there any advantage to transmitting something verbally? Isn't it always better to write it down? I mean, anyone who's done any contracts will know, if it's not written down, goodbye, Charlie. You know what I mean? I had a contractor in Israel. Had we not written explicitly we needed doors in our apartment, we would have had a concrete block that we could not get into. And he would have said, well, it didn't say doors. I built a house, no doors. We would have had to, like, smash through with hammers and stuff like that. So, obviously, write everything down. What's the advantage of telling it verbally? That's question number two. Question number three is, how do we know it's transmitted accurately? Maybe someone messed up along the way. Maybe a bunch of people messed up along the way. Maybe deliberately or accidentally, but someone distorted the tradition and it was not transmitted accurately. That's the third question we're going to address. Questions are clear? Okay, good. Let's start with the first question. Why do we need an oral Torah? Well, first of all, as I'm sure you're aware, the Hebrew language is almost the exact opposite of Hawaiian. I mean, that goes without explanation, right? It's a type of obvious. No? Okay. Well, okay, Hawaiian is almost all vowels, right? It's like Hawaiian's like 11 sounds in the entire alphabet, right? Whereas Hebrew is all consonants. Where do you get the vowel sounds in the Hebrew language? If you look at the text of the Torah scroll, take the Torah out of the Ark, you look at the text, are there vowels?
Nope.
There are no vowels. Where are the vowels? They're dots and the dashes, right? And the kudot. They were invented much, much later. How do you know how to pronounce? For example, can anyone read the first word here?
Yira.
The first word.
Yira.
What? Yira, that means fear. Yira, that means see. Anyone else? Yira, he shall be seen. Okay, which one is it? I suppose if you look at the verse, it says three times a year all the men shall yudresh alaf hay in front of God. Now what does that mean? Does that mean three times a year all the men shall fear God? My wife says that would be wonderful if they did. Three times would be great. Would be already an improvement. Right? Or does it mean three times a year they shall see God? All Jewish men are guaranteed they'll see God three times a year. Or does it mean you have to go to Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, three times a year, yei ra'eh, to be seen in his presence? Which one does it mean? Number three. What about the second word there? Remember the second word?
Chalav.
Milk. So for instance, when the Torah says, kol, all, chet lamed beit, lo tochelu, don't eat. Chalav, don't eat milk. You can't have milk. I know we're lactose intolerant, but I mean, well, you know, why you can't have milk? The answer is chalev is how it's read, which means what? Chalev is a certain type of fat in the around the kidney and loin area of the animal. But of course, you look a few verses afterwards and it says, don't cook a kid in its mother's... Not chalev, don't cook a kid in its mother's fat. It means you can't deep fry. You can say goodbye to most of our recipes, right? Rather, it's don't cook a kid in its mother's...
Milk.
Right, which is prohibition against pepperoni pizza. And then, what about this one? Zachar, which means male. Zecher, which means remembrance. Okay, Zocher, which means remember. Okay, there's a lot of words in the Hebrew language. And the truth is, if you don't have the vowels, you actually don't know how to even read the Torah. How do we know how to read the Torah? How do you know how to read the Torah? When Christians translate it into English, Muslims translate it into Arabic. When anyone translates it, when we read the Torah, how do we know how it's pronounced? The answer is, we heard it pronounced by someone else. How did he know? He heard it pronounced by someone else. In other words, the way that we know how to pronounce the Torah, we have from the oral tradition, Torah Sheba'al Peh. That's number one. In addition, as you all know, punctuation does not appear in the Torah. You look in the Torah, there's no punctuation. No apostrophes, no commas, no full stops, no periods, nothing. No colons, semicolons, hyphens, nothing. When you don't have punctuation, you have a problem. I bought my wife recently this book. Anyone seen this book? It's called Eats, Shoots and Leaves. Now, does that tell me that pandas are very violent creatures? They eat, shoot, and then leave? Or that's if you put a comma in, eats, shoots, bang bang, and then leaves. Or if you don't put a comma in, what does it mean? That a panda eats, shoots, and leaves. You know, tree shoots and leaves, bamboo shoots and leaves. So punctuation is very important. I'll give you some other examples of this. We're in En Gedi, in Israel, and we went swimming, and the security guard comes over and he says, can't you read the sign that says no swimming allowed? I said, that's how you read it? I read it differently. No! Swimming allowed. Or, for example, the story is told that Stalin received a telegram from Trotsky. As you know, Stalin, his greatest enemy was Trotsky. He reads out the telegram. The telegram says, Dear Stalin, I was wrong, you were right, I should apologize, Trotsky. A Jew in the audience, so Stalin says, you see, my greatest enemy has admitted that I am right. He says, I'm wrong, you're right, I should apologize, Trotsky. A Jew in the audience says, Comrade Stalin, may I please read it with greater emotion? Stalin says, certainly, ethnic comrade. Come up and read it. So the Jew reads it a little differently. He says, Dear Stalin, I was wrong. You were right. I should apologize. Trotsky. Which is a little bit different when you come to think about it. So you see, you need punctuation. Where do we get the punctuation from in the Torah? Anyone know? How do you know where to stop, start, emphasize? How do you know this? Well, when you go to the synagogue, do you hear the Torah being read? No. You hear it being sung. The notes with which we sing the Torah, all communities have certain things in common. Where to stop, where to start, the commas, the emphasis, the pauses, the hesitation, the enthusiasm, these are all part of what we call the oral tradition. So therefore, in order to read the Torah, to understand the language, in order to know how it's pronounced, in order to know where to stop and where to start, what the punctuation is, whether it says no swimming allowed, or whether it says slow children crossing, or it says slow children crossing, right? All of that is an order for you have to have the oral tradition. And so therefore, one aspect of the oral Torah is just to read the Torah itself. Now secondly, legal definitions. The Torah above all is a legal text. The Torah tells me things like, for example, it says, on the 10th day of the 7th month, you shall afflict your soul. Anyone tell me what that means? What's the 10th day of the 7th month? Anyone know? 10th day of the 7th month. Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement. Very good. Okay, what does it mean to afflict your soul? It says, afflict your soul. What does that mean?
Sure.
Roll around on thumbtacks? Read Russian novels? Right? What is it? Oblomov? You haven't read that? Oh my God. Right, anyway, but I mean, so basically, right, so what does it mean? The answer is it means, what does it mean to afflict your soul? The oral Torah tells us don't eat and don't drink. In other words, fast. But you see, if you don't have an oral tradition, how do you know what to do? The Torah says on Shabbat, it says, don't work on Shabbat. What's work? Can anyone define work? There are some people who would not know work if it hit them, right? But what is work? So if you would ask a physicist, the physicist would say work equals force times distance, or force times displacement would be more correct, right? W equals FD. If you would ask someone, an accountant, he would say work is whatever you get paid for, right? It doesn't matter how much you enjoy it, doesn't matter how much how relaxing it is. If you get paid for it, the IRS wants all your money. Basically, that's it, right? So now, what is work? Someone told me work is whatever you do during the week for a living. I said, that's very interesting. So I have a friend who works for a government think tank. What does he do during the week? He thinks. What should he do on Shabbat? Put himself in a drug-induced stupor for 24 hours? Watch television for the same amount of time to stop rational thought? Is that what he should do? Right? What should he do? So you see, you've got to have a definition. Let's take something as simple as don't murder. Torah says don't murder. Is that a simple law? No, it's fairly simple. Most people here, I'm sure, no one here probably has murdered. I'm hoping, right? Right. So let's say, a little uncomfortable that people are showing such, hesitation and saying, no, definitely not. Okay, whatever. Anyway, but basically, it says don't murder. How do you define murder? How do you define murder? Don't you have to define what's self-defense? Do you have to define what is it? Who's murder? Like, for instance, if I kill an ape, is that murder? If I kill a human being? What's a human being? When's a human... In other words, what about stem cell reasons, right? So let's say you've got some leftover embryonic cells. Leftover fertilized embryonic cells from a fertility clinic in the freezer with the Haagen-Dazs, right? So you take one of those out and use it for experimentation. And you chuck it out afterwards. Is that murder? The Catholics say that's murder. Judaism says that's not murder. Not murder. Got not a human yet. What about abortion? What about someone like who is in a persistent vegetative state, like Shaivo, the Karen Shaivo case? Is that murder? The answer is yes. In other words, you have to define. There's many, many things to define. So it's not enough just to look at the five books of Moses, the Chumash, and say, oh, it's simple. It says don't murder. That's not simple at all. So in order to, first of all, read the Torah and pronounce it, in order to know the punctuation, and in order to understand the details of the laws, we have to have the oral tradition. And in fact, the Torah hints to this. The Torah says, you shall slaughter of your cattle and your flocks as I have commanded you. It is interesting, nowhere in the entire Torah does God say how to kill an animal. It doesn't say. It does say, you shall slaughter the animal as I have commanded you. Let me ask you a question. Where did he command us how to slaughter the animal? What would be the answer? In the oral Torah. The way I understand it is the following. The relationship between the oral Torah and the written Torah is like this. The written Torah are like lecture notes, and the oral Torah is like the lecture itself. If anyone has been to a lecture on a subject, anyone here studying chemistry? Chemistry? A few people studying chemistry? Okay, when you go to a lecture on chemistry, do you write out the entire name of the substance? Would you write, for instance, sodium chloride? What would you write? You'd write NaCl. NaCl, correct? Right, NaCl. Okay. Would you write gold? What would you write? AU. Okay. Would you write lead? No, you'd write PB. In other words, you'd have a whole bunch of symbols. So in any specialized area, don't you use symbols all the time, correct? So supposing you just went to a fascinating chemistry lecture, if there could be such a thing. Let's pretend. Okay. You went to this fascinating chemistry lecture, and you're sitting in the school cafeteria reading the notes to your lecture, which you wrote in your chemistry shorthand. And an English literature major comes over to you, and you're sitting there, and he says to you, oh, looks like you had a fascinating lecture. It's, oh, it was one of the best lectures of the year. It was about the heavy particles, whatever, anyway. So deuterium and the whole world. So he says, oh, can I look at the notes? I say, sure, no problem. So I give him the notes. He looks at it. You've been drinking this stuff? This makes no sense. NaCl? What's NaCl? This makes no sense. This is gobbledygook. Okay, what is his problem? I mean, aside from being an English lit major, what are the other problems? What's the other problem? His problem is, I'll tell you what his problem is. You know what his problem is? He doesn't know, he didn't hear the lecture, and he doesn't know the shorthand. But had he heard the lecture, let's say a chemistry major comes over, And the chemistry major, their laptop was down. They couldn't take notes, but they heard the lecture, and they know the shorthand. If they'd look at your class notes, would they be able to figure it out more or less? I would say so. So, you know what the lecture is? The oral Torah. Do you know what the written notes are? 5 books of Moses. When did the Jews get the lecture? Anyone know when did the Jews get the lecture, the full lecture of the oral law? 40 years in the desert. What are we doing for 40 years? Think about it. 40 years, right? We had no problems with food. We had no problems with clothing, right? All the bad stuff, according to the most commentaries, happened in the first and last year. Middle 38 years, what are the Jews doing? Nice night out, isn't it? Again, right? I mean, what are they, you know, standing there doing? Well, it's nice. It's not humid, at least. You can't complain about that. I mean, what are they doing? 38 years. The answer is, for 38 years, the Jews were absorbing the Torah. And they were getting the whole lecture, 40-year lecture. Who were their teachers? Moses and Aaron and Miriam and the greatest teachers ever. So it was the ultimate seminar, 40 years of it, right? Viennese table every night. None, of course, but okay, whatever. Right? But the whole was, it was an incredible thing. And the notes for that, so that means if you heard the lecture and I tell you one of the coded notes, you know what it means. I would say probably most people here have heard quite a bit of the lecture. If I would tell most people here, folks, I want you to do is tomorrow morning, bind a sign upon your arms and stick a frontlet between your eyes. What would you do? You put on tefillin. That's correct, because you heard some of the lecture. But if you didn't hear the lecture, and I told you to stick a frontlet between your eyes, what would you do? Go to a piercing parlor? I'd like a frontlet right there, please. Oh, sure, give me the 3/4-inch drill bit, will you, mate? I mean, what? Put your head in the clamp, sir. I mean, what does that mean? Put a sign upon your arm. What does that mean? Tattoo a Jewish mother on your bicep? I don't understand. So obviously, right, the Torah is designed not for someone who's not part of the club. The Torah is designed for someone who's part of the club. So if you are part of the Jewish people, most likely you've heard a lot of the lecture. And therefore, I only have to tell you a little code word, like afflict your soul on Yom Kippur, and you'll know it means don't eat and drink, which for Jews is the ultimate affliction. But again, right, that's the idea ultimately is that the way the Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah related is like lecture notes in the lecture. That answers our first question. Okay, the first question was, what's the purpose? Why do we need the oral tradition? Our second question was, what's the advantage of an oral tradition? What's the advantage? Right? Why not write everything down? So first I should point out that in most systems of knowledge transmission, a lot of things are not written down. If anyone has studied medicine, I've asked a lot of physicians the following question. Where did you learn more about the diagnosis and care of patients? 4 years in medical school or when you were working in the hospital? Almost all of them said working in the hospital. I asked lawyers, where did you learn more about the practice of law? 4 years in law school or when you were in a law office? They said, in a law office. What's the difference between Harvard and Texas A&M? Aside from $30,000. Right. Now, the textbook's the same? There's no university. Right? Patterson Community College can get the same textbooks as Yale. No problem. And you just get onto Amazon, you get the same textbooks. What's the difference? You know what the difference is? Who's teaching? Who you communicate with, whom you are communicating, with whom you are interacting, the whole, it's an oral tradition. And there are a lot of things you cannot learn from the written word. I want a little test here. Who knows how to swim? Everyone put your hands up. Who knows how to swim? Everyone knows how to swim. Put your hand up, please. Okay, put your hands down. Anyone who learned how to swim from a book, please put your hand up. Anyone? No, you see, I've done this survey all over the world. I've surveyed thousands of people. No one who learned how to swim from a book has ever put their hand up. You know why? I'll tell you why. Tragically, people who learn how to swim from a book are not with us. There are a lot of things that you need to have a human being teaching you. A friend of mine who's an English teacher told me a great exercise he has for kids in his class. He has the children. He says, I want everyone to write step-by-step instructions of how to tie a shoelace. Instructions how to tie a shoelace, step-by-step. And then everyone in class exchanges their instructions with each other. And then basically only following what is written on that person's instructions, tie your shoelace. It is horrific. There are kids hanging from the ceiling. There's kids tied up. It's unbelievable, right? It is, you see, There are certain things, skills. The Torah is here to teach us, not just information. The Torah is here to teach us how to live. And to learn how to live, it is not enough to have a written word. You've got to have a human being. And that is part of the oral tradition. In addition, it's also portable and compact. Meaning, the Torah, the written law itself, is very compact. It's a very short book. But you see, if you've got that intact, and you've got the rules and the methodology of deriving things from it, which is the oral law, you can transport it very easily. Jews have been thrown out of almost every country we've ever lived in. You know, except in recent times, thank God for the democracies. But that meant that for us to have to preserve entire libraries with total accuracy would be very rough. But if we have to preserve only a small text, and you know what? That small text, the five books of Moses, is not like email. If you send a long file over the email, over the internet, what should you do to that file? You compress it, correct? Right? If you don't, when you compress the file, right, the other person has a decompression, like unzip, right? They unzip the file. So the same is true of the Torah. You see, the Torah, the five books of Moses, is the zipped file. It's compressed. The Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, that is the unzip program. And that program expands it, and so now we only have to carry a portable thing, the rest we can figure out. In addition, although this sounds counterintuitive, but it is harder to steal it and distort it if it's up there than if it's written down. Think about this carefully. If I think something, can anyone distort that? No, of course not. If I say it, can you distort it? Yes, you can misquote me. Right, what if I write it down? Goodbye, Charlie. Right? It's gone. Right? And people can take it and do what they want with it. So you see, it is much harder to steal and distort something which is up there and in there than if it's written down. And think of what has happened to our Torah, the written Torah. Yeah, it's exactly, I'll tell you, I was in London, I was lecturing at a school in London in the religion department. And so the chaplain took me into the religion department and he shows me the walls. The walls got these beautiful posters which have all the major principles of the great religions of the world. So it had the Ten Commandments of Judaism, and it had the five pillars of Islam, and it had the eight paths to Nirvana of Buddhism, and it had various things like that. So I said to the chaplain there, I said, look, excuse me, but there's a few mistakes on the posters. A few mistakes on the posters. He says, I beg your pardon. I mean, chutzpah, but first I'm Australian, you know, and he's English, right? And secondly, I'm a rabbi, right? So I said, there's a few mistakes on your posters. Okay, he said, I said, first of all, Judaism's got 613 commandments, not 10. We should get a lot more wall space than this. It's clearly an act of anti-Semitism, right? But I said, I'll leave that one for you, okay? Right, but you said, because you maybe only saw the movie and didn't read the book. But, however, right, in the movie there's only 10. So, but I said another thing. You see, under Christianity, one of the major principles of Christianity I've listed here is love your neighbour as yourself. He said, that's indeed, that's a Christian principle. I said, no, it's not. I said, it's a Jewish principle. He said, but it's in Matthew chapter 6. I said, but it's in Leviticus chapter 19. And Leviticus chapter 19 came 2,000 years before Matthew chapter 6. He says, really? And I said, well, look it up. And I said, not only is Matthew 6 taking it from Leviticus, but actually misquotes it. Because if you look in Matthew, what it says there is, love. You have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, turn the other cheek. Resist not evil. It doesn't say that in the Torah. Does it say hate your enemy?
No.
It wasn't say in the Torah, love your neighbour as yourself. Ani Hashem, I am God. It doesn't say hate your enemy. But I said, not only is it misquoted, but this is what has happened. Our Torah, people have taken it, distorted it, misquoted it, or if it's a good thing, they've taken it as their own. We said it. A woman once told a friend of mine she was thinking of becoming a Christian. He asked her, why? What do you see in Christianity? She said, the beauty of the Psalms. Tehillim. The beauty of the Psalms. He said, first he laughed, then he cried. He said, because who wrote the Psalms? They're originally King David, 10 Jews. They're written in Hebrew. And she says, oh, the beauty of the Psalms. That's why she's become a Christian, for heaven's sakes. So that has not happened to the oral law. Because the oral law has been, where has it been written? Up there. Much harder to steal it from me if it's written up there. In addition, amongst the Jewish people, we find a very interesting thing. It's called the study ethic. You know what Jews do in their spare time? It's an amazing thing. You know, what do Jews do in their spare time? We study. Look, the proof is, look at yourselves. Right? What are you doing? It's a beautiful Sunday night. There are a lot of people out there barbecuing, and you are sitting here studying, listening to a lecture. That's weird. I mean, no offense, anyone. Some of my best friends are Jewish. My wife's Jewish, the whole world. Right? However, what we do is study. But and you know what? But that study ethic has done a lot of tremendous stuff for us, hasn't it? Think of how we have excelled in so many areas of the academia, in the media, in literature, in arts, in science, in so many areas. Why have Jews excelled so much? You know why? We have the study ethic. We study in our spare time. It's an amazing thing. A non-Jewish scholar was in Warsaw in Poland before the Second World War. He was looking for a taxi. There was a whole row of horse-drawn carriages lined up, the taxis, and there were no in the Jewish area, and there's no driver. So there's a little kid there. He walks over to the kid, and he says, excuse me, where are the drivers? The kid says, come, I'll show you. Takes him into a small synagogue, Beit Knesset, and you know what? The Jewish taxi drivers are sitting around. You know what they're doing? They were studying Mishnah. They were studying Jewish law. I've heard taxi drivers take off time to pray, and certainly their passengers pray regularly. However, right, to take off time to study, right, who does that? Can you imagine? You're in Manhattan, in the city. You're looking for a yellow cab. No yellow cabs. They're outside the New York Public Library. There's a whole row of yellow cabs, no drivers. And there's a kid, member of the Crips or Bloods, standing there watching the taxis. So you walk over to him, and you say in your, excuse me, sup dog. Excuse me, my dear homie, but I would like to get back to my hood, and specifically to the crib, and I was just wondering if you could tell me where the drivers of these conveyances are. And he says, and he'll say something like, which I cannot repeat, but he says, come, I'll show you. He takes you into the New York Public Library, and there, New York taxi driver's sitting around studying the Constitution. How likely do you think this is? First of all, they should study driving. English, I think, will be a close second. Right? But, I mean, think of it. How many societies does your average person study? You know, it's an amazing thing. I saw in the Yivo Museum in New York, there is a set of Mishnah, Jewish legal texts, owned by the Woodcutters Society of Minsk. The woodcutters of Minsk would come home. What does a woodcutter do in any society? Come home from work, right, have a six-pack of Fosters, watch the cricket on television, slap the kids around a bit, and go to sleep. Right? But the Jewish woodcutters of Minsk, basically, what would they do after work? They'd study law. You know, all this comes from the oral tradition. Because you see, if it's all written down, what do you need to do to preserve it? Have a nice bookshelf. Right? Humility-controlled nice bookshelf. If it's not written down, what do you need to do to preserve it? You need to study. If it's not written down, the only way it will survive is if there's a nationwide effort at studying. And, you know, it's interesting. It's an amazing thing. Just recently, a couple of months ago, we celebrated the completion of the Babylonian Talmud, 7.5-year cycle. Do you know what that means? That means there are people who get up 5 o'clock in the morning, or they go to a class at midnight or close to midnight, every single day, 7.5 years, right, learning 3,000 or 2,700 or so pages of Talmud. There's on the Long Island Railroad, right, the 752, I think, to New York, to the city, there is an entire section designated for a Talmud class. They completed the cycle on the Long Island Railroad every day. That's an amazing thing. Do people have such dedication? Right? And we're not talking about professional Jews. We're not talking about rabbis. We're talking about anyone. That is part of the oral law. The living Torah and the study ethic. It's beautiful. You know, it's interesting. No, do I have a picture of it? No. But it's interesting. If you look at many synagogues. Oh, right here. Look at the tablets of the law on that ark. Look at the shape of them. See that shape? Is that right? Is that historically accurate? What shape were the tablets? They were square, right? They were square or rectangle. They were probably cubes, right? So the question is, why do synagogues all over the world have it shaped like that? It's wrong. So you know what the standard answer is? Michelangelo. Michelangelo's statue of Moses, they were rounded. So does it make sense to you? Some rabbi, right, somewhere in Georgia, or somewhere in Poland, somewhere in Russia, etc. And he says, look, the Midrash, the Talmud, everyone says it's square. And then the interior decorator comes in and says, oh, but Rabbi, Michelangelo says they're round. He says, the Rabbi says, oh, okay, fine.
Yeah.
I mean, since when Rabbi's so easygoing? Right? Or, I mean, what happened? Was it Feng Shui? Oh, no, they have to be round so that energy can come out of the arc. It doesn't make sense. I'll tell you, the reason they are rounded is because the verse says the following. Katvein aluach libcha. Write the words of Torah on the tablets of your heart. The heart has two rounded chambers. When we draw a heart, how do we draw a heart? Two rounded chambers. So the tablets of the law are supposed to symbolize the top half is the human heart and the bottom is stone. Where's the Torah meant to be written? Not just on stone. It's meant to be written on the heart as well. That's what the oral law does. In addition, the fact that the Torah is verbal, oral, requires that I go to another human being. That's very important. We want to encourage contact with the previous generation because we are going to learn also how to conduct ourselves. In not all cultures is this so. You know, Bertrand Russell, very famous British philosopher who taught at City University of New York. He was thrown out, actually. But he used to teach a course in relationship ethics. Sexuality, relationship ethics. It was rumoured at the time that he had was carrying on in an immoral fashion with at least two students in his class. So he's teaching a course in ethics, you understand? Right? So relationship ethics, right? So a student comes over and says, Lord Russell, how can you teach a class in ethics and you can carry on like this? So Lord Russell said, my dear fellow, is the geometry professor a triangle? He can teach geometry without being a triangle. I can teach ethics without being ethical. He didn't see that as a problem. Right? So you see, but in Judaism it's not like that. We have to, we are transmitting something which we passionately believe in. And all the members of those who were transmitting it were transmitting something not because it was a job. Right? Not because there's, oh well, you know what, I can get some prestigious way, but rather because we actually believe in it. In addition, it's an anti-superficiality device. If everything was just written down, what would that train us to do? Just do this. Oh yeah, simple. Oh yeah, simple. What does Judaism train us to do? Whoa! What's that mean? Right? It trains us to never take things on a superficial level. Do not learn the Torah superficially. Do not look at the world superficially. Do not look at another human being superficially. We are being trained. Is, you know what happens? You ever seen a religious who picks up a Torah? Here's what happens. Their thumb starts twitching. Right? And their eyes narrow. What's that? And we start asking questions. Right? And because the Torah has trained us to dig beneath the surface, because that's where the truth is. The truth is not superficial, truth is beneath the surface. In addition, there's the Tai Chi principle of the oral law. Everyone familiar with Tai Chi? You know what Tai Chi is? Tai Chi is a Chinese martial art. It's like it's performed slowly as an exercise. You see people in the park sometimes doing that. Yeah. You've seen that, right? Okay. So Tai Chi is actually, if it's done fast, actually a martial art. This is actually a blow to the chin, right? So it's actually a martial art. So there's a thing in Tai Chi, a principle called to change enough to stay the same. Change enough to stay the same. I'll say it in Chinese. Change enough to stay the same. Right? So basically, that's the principle. So it's like this. They have a thing called the Tai Chi term, which is like this. That's a Tai Chi term. Very nice, relaxing thing to do. Now, the purpose of the Tai Chi turn is that if someone pushes you in the shoulder, right, most people's reaction, someone pushes you in the shoulder is push back, in which case you are off balance, and if they're stronger, you'll fall over. Tai Chi turn is, they push you in the shoulder, what do? Right, in other words, you turn, right, so that they, who's off balance now? They're off balance. They turn, right, you turn with it, and therefore now they are bent over. So you can now combine that with the head behind the neck and the knee into the face. However, the concept of the Tai Chi principle is found in the oral Torah, not the face, not the knee into the face, but the other part. Right? That is to say that the Torah is done in such a way that it actually is it can change enough to stay the same. In other words, the Jewish people We have changing circumstances around us all the time. We're confronted with different problems in every country, in every generation. And yet it's an amazing thing that the Torah has been able to be stable and to stabilize us and to give us a high quality of life in all circumstances, all times. Because since it is not everything's written down, but there is a possibility of much of it coming through the minds of the sages, that gives a certain amount of flexibility. Not total flexibility, but Tai Chi flexibility, which is to change enough to stay the same. That's answer to question number two, which is, what's the advantage of a verbal oral transmission? Okay, that's question number two. What was question number three? How do we know it was accurate? Now, in Australia, we used to play a game in school, in elementary school, called Broken Telephone. In America, that probably means vandalising the public phones, right? But that's not... No, what I'm referring to here is the game was the following game. The teacher, you know, would take the class, you know, divide, let's say, 20 kids in the class, take two groups of 10, would whisper something to the first person in each group, okay? And then the next person would whisper it to the next person, and the next person to the next person, and in the end, the last kid in each group would write on the board what message they heard. Anyone played that? What do you call that? Telephone.
Broken
telephone. Okay. So that now, what generally happens to the message?
Completely changed.
It's messed up. So now, people will ask the following question. Hold on. Jews have been doing this for 1,500 years. The Torah was given in 1313 BCE. It was not written down. The oral law was written down in the Mishnah, but not until about 200 CE. That's about 1,500 years. So for 1,500 years, people are going, pass it on. Right? And oh, that should be fine. No distortion. In 10 minutes in the classroom. Goodbye. Right? 1,500 years. So there's a few ideas here. Number one, little basic information theory. Let's say, instead of just two groups of kids in the class, let's do a thought experiment. Let's say we had 10 groups of 10 children in the class. God forbid you should have 100 children in the class. But let's say 10 groups of 10 children in the class, right? And you gave the same message to the leader of each group, and then they all transmitted it, and then at the end, each one of them wrote down the message. Would that increase or decrease your chance of knowing what the original message was?
Decrease.
It would actually increase it. Think about it carefully. I'll give you an example. Let's say the message was, I'll tell you the message, A, B, C, D. What did I say?
A, B, C, D.
A, B, C, D. Everyone hear A, B, C, D? Not everyone heard, right? Now, supposing I had 10 groups of 10 kids. So one group, they hear A, B, C, D. There's another group of kids, right? They're into old-time rock and roll. They hear A, C, D, C. Okay? That's all they hear, A, C, D, C. Right? There's another kid, all he's ever heard an adult say to him is ADHD. Right? So he writes down ADHD. Right? He tells the next kid. There's another kid who's not used to the beauty, the poetry of the Australian accent. Right? And he thinks I said IBCD. Right? So he says IBCD. Okay? So now, but think of it the following way. What are you going to have at the end of this? You know what you're going to have at the end of all this? You're going to have a chart. You're going to have group, one group, 8 out of 10 groups said the first letter was A. 9 out of 10 groups said the second letter was B. 7 out of 10 groups said the third letter was C. 8 out of 10 groups said the fourth letter was D. So what you're going to have is, everyone going to make the same mistake? No. So what you're going to have is a statistical average, and you're going to know that the original message was A, B, C, D. By the way, in computer technology, they do this to test hard drives. You get cheap, easily copied hard drives to test a hard drive. You copy it numerous parallel times, and you check the accuracy, right? And so what you do is you copy it many times. For instance, I want to get a message to someone. I will call them on their home phone, call them on their cell phone, leave a message on their office phone, send them an email, right? Send an email to their office, email to their BlackBerry, right? I'll send them a fax, a singing telegram, and a smoke signal, okay? They're going to hate me at the end, but they'll get the message. Right? Because even if the singing telegram guy gets mugged, right, and the fax machine's out of paper, right, and their wife broke the BlackBerry, it doesn't matter, they will still... My wife calls it a crackberry, right, because it's addictive. Okay, but basically, right, they're going to get the message. The same is true. How many chains transmitted the oral law? Think carefully. How many chains were transmitting the oral law? More than that. Every father and son, every mother and daughter, every grandparent and grandchild. We just sat at the Seder about a month and a half ago, right? About 3 weeks ago. 3 weeks ago, right? So we sat at the Seder, right? So did you hear the story of the Exodus and all that? Maybe from your grandparent?
Yeah.
Who'd your grandparent hear it from? Their grandparent. Their parent. the grandparent, etc. The oral law, every Jewish family is another chain. When they got together at the end of 1,500 years, it was the funnel at the end. You could write the chart. And if you look at the Mishnah actually does that. It evaluates different traditions. And it looks at the majority and says, this is it. So number one, information theory tells me when you have thousands of chains, millions of chains, you've increased your chances of accuracy. Number two, the message is not a sudden, it's not a surprise. For instance, when I said A, B, C, D, you didn't know that I'd be saying that message. That was a surprise to you. But supposing you'd been hearing the message since you were a little baby. When does someone start learning the Oral Torah? In a normal, regular, traditional Jewish family, when do you start learning about Judaism? Earlier than that. As soon as the kid opens their eyes. As soon as the kid opens their eyes. Why? What do they see their first Friday night? They see candles. They hear Shabbat song. They hear Kiddush. Maybe you give them a little bit of wine on the finger, etc. They hear this, right? By the time the kid is 2 or 3 years old, they know quite a bit about Shabbat. They know quite a bit about what's kosher, not kosher. They know quite a bit about all this. They're not learning it from a book. My son Rafi, he was on the video. He was feeding the little bunny rabbit.
Yeah.
The French fry. Rafi, right, doesn't learn about, he doesn't know about Judaism from books. He knows about Judaism from living it. Right, he knows about Judaism from living it. We started teaching him. So in other words, it's much harder, much, much harder to forget about something when you started learning it when you were 0.1 years old or whatever, than if you start learning it just as a shock. I come out of the blue, it's like, A, B, C, D. Right, that's a lot harder. In addition, the message is a logical message. That is to say, the oral tradition is based, much of it has got logical rules governing it. If I give you a series of numbers which are random, and you forget the numbers, or some of the numbers, you are, hope is lost, correct? Because you can't, how can you know what the numbers are? It's random, okay? But if I give you a logical, an arithmetic progression, geometric progression, Fibonacci sequence, whatever, and you forget some of the numbers, can you reconstruct it?
Yes.
As long as you know the algorithm, you can reconstruct it. The same is true in the oral law. There is a logical interface here. There are rules and regulations behind it. In addition, the Torah is, you know, people have this impression, how is, you know, someone else told me this. I asked him, how do you think the oral law was transmitted? So this is what he said. He said, well, there's this old rabbi, he's on his deathbed, and he's lying there, and he calls over his top student. He says, Yossel, come here. Yossel says, what is it? He says, I'm going. He says, where are you going? He says, I'm dying, all right? He says, oh, okay. He says, okay. He says, I've got to tell you the oral tradition. And the guy, the student says, oh, whoa. Let me just get a pen and paper. He says, hello, oral. He says, oh, okay, right? So he says, okay. And he says, he tells him the entire oral tradition. Then he goes, Yossel waits till he's dying. Yossel's lying on his death, but he calls over his soul. He can't wait to use the line about oral, right? He calls over his soul. Is that how it happened?
No.
I mean, do people wait till they're dying to tell you the oral law? No. Right? You teach it again and again. There's review, there's mnemonic, there's a whole system. No one waits. I told the guy, where did you get this from? He says, I don't know, I saw it in a movie somewhere, Chaim Potok novel, whatever. But I mean, it's ridiculous. That's in addition. Also, in the ancient world, do you know what? Most information in the ancient world was actually transmitted verbally, not in writing, because it was very difficult to record things. In ancient Greece, it was not so easy. People didn't have palm pilots, blackberries. In ancient Greece, you're a businessman. You have to walk around with a stone tablet and a chisel. Oh, when do you want to meet? Oh, what's that? And it's like, you know, you put it in the purse, and you have to do it Roman numerals, for heaven's sake. And if you made a mistake, smash, right, go to the quarry, get another stone tablet, right? I mean, if you're really trendy, you've got stone tablets all over you, right? All of these chisels, right? This is not how it worked. In the ancient world, it was not so easy to record information. And you know what? In terms of before the invention of things like palm pilots and stuff, people had this thing they used to use. It's called memory. RAM, right? Right? It's called memory. People actually used to use their memory. And in the ancient world, people had a lot of techniques to use their memory. Mnemonic devices. People use them still today, right? Anyone here use mnemonic devices? Medical students probably use them, right? Mnemonic devices. Like, oh, simple ones like Roy G. Biv, right? For the colors of red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, right? Planets of the solar system? My very earnest mother just showed us nine planets. My very earnest mother just showed us. Well, the whole bunch of things like that. In the oral tradition as well, we also have mnemonic devices, rhymes, tunes. There was a whole system of how to memorize things in the ancient world. And finally, there was the inertia of a whole society and state. Because you see, when the oral law was oral, where did the Jews live, most Jews? Two places, Israel and Babylon. So who ruled the Jews? Jews. Even in Babylon, we had autonomy. A lot of the Jews had independence because we had our own, we were allowed to use our own rule. Which means, what was the law of the land? Jewish law. It's a lot easier to forget something. We're in America, right? And it's those who know, right? And we're a tiny, the Jews are a tiny minority in the country, and a tiny minority of Jews actually keep the oral law. But you imagine if you're living in a country where everyone is doing that. That's the law of the land. You know, the police pulls you over, says, excuse me, sir, is that a milkshake you've got there? I say, yes. And is that a wrapper from a beef burger I see in the car? I say, yeah. And he says, could you please breathe into the metalizer? 5 hours. Okay, I'll let you off this time, but with a warning. Right? In other words, you see, in those times, for most of history, there was actually law enforcement. Jewish law, I don't know exactly they did that, but you know, Jewish law was actually the law of the land. So it's a lot harder to forget something when that's the inertia of the whole society, the whole state, the whole culture is doing that. And now, we come to some external evidence. First of all, history tells us that even amongst those who rejected the oral law, there was a uniform acceptance of certain basic principles, like the Karaites, for instance. There were artifacts that predate the Mishnah. For instance, there are tefillin which were found from 2,100 years ago that are the same as our tefillin today. And tefillin is not mentioned in the Torah explicitly. It's mostly all the laws, oral tradition. The mikveh that was found in Masada from 2,200 years ago is exactly the same design as most modern-day mikvehs, based on the 16th century code of Jewish law. And yet this mikveh was built 400 years before the Mishnah was written down. The Dead Sea Scrolls, which contain a tremendous wealth of material about a lot of the oral tradition, exactly in accordance with our understanding of it. There is a Jewish calendar. Jewish communities all over the world have the consistent Jewish calendar, even though the Jewish calendar is based purely on oral tradition. There's only two verses in the whole Torah that talk about it. One says, this month shall be the first month, and the other one says, guard the month of spring. From this, we're supposed to figure out an entire calendar. 6,000-year calendar? Could you do that? No, that's all oral tradition. And yet Jews all over the world, even communities that had no relationship to each other, still had a universal calendar. Two more points, and then we're going to end. Any Kohanim here? Kohanim. Kohen? 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 Yes. How do you know you're a Kohen? Your grandfather told you. How do you know you're a Kohen? His grandfather told you? That's where he's from. Okay. So, your grandfather told you. Okay, fine. Right, so, anyone else here a Kohen? Family of Kohanim? So, it's interesting. This is an oral tradition, isn't it? Do you have any writing? You don't have any writing, right? I'm a Levite, right? How do I know I'm a Levi? My father told me. Right? The same is true. Right? So, how do we know? This is very interesting. There was a Jewish scientist. There is a Jewish scientist in London who thought about this, and he said, this is a very interesting thing. All these people who are Kohanim are claiming that they're descended on their father's side from Aaron, the brother of Moses, the high priest who lived 3,300 years ago. He says, I wonder if there's any genetic marker about this. So he did a test on Kohanim in England, in Israel, and in the United States. And he found, in the male chromosome, he found a certain mutation called the Cohen modal haplotype, CMH. He found in over 75% of Jews who said they were Kohanim had this same, it's a harmless mutation, but they had a certain marker in their genes. And there's a certain built-in time clock in the DNA called the cytochrome C mutation rate. And he said, from that he calculated that the common ancestor of all these people lived approximately 3,000 years ago. Now, it's not like you look in the genes and it says Aaron was here. It doesn't look like in the helix. It doesn't say that. Right. However, statistically, it's a very, very strong evidence for something which is a purely oral tradition. And finally, there is Chamim. I do not know what you call it in your community, but Jewish community...
Excuse
me. Sorry. In Jewish communities all over the world have a type of stew which we eat Shabbat lunchtime. What do you guys call it? Oshislaw. Okay, anyway. Okay, he's been here. Okay, anyway. So now, it works like this. Now, Jewish communities all over the world, have a similar thing. Now, what's interesting is, right, Jewish communities, Ashkenazi Jews call it Cholot. Right, a lot of Sephardi Jews call it Chamin. Jews in Morocco call it Orissa. Some call it Sahina. It happened, but it's interesting. The Museum of Natural History of the United States has a magazine called Natural History Magazine. They feature an exotic food once a month. They once featured cholent as the exotic food. Whatever. Anyway, they featured it. And the author of the article made a very interesting point. He said, you know what, it's interesting, he says, all Jewish communities around the world have some version of this. But he says, every community has a different recipe. Every community. The Jews of Calcutta, India, it's rice and curry and chicken. The Jews in Poland, it's basically beans and potatoes. Right? In Morocco, it is crack wheat and garlic and napalm. Right? But basically, different communities have different customs as to what they put in it. He says, the question we have to ask is, what unites all these as one dish? He says, the answer is, it's a protest food. There was a group of Jews called Karaites, Karaim. The Karaites, they did not believe in the oral tradition. So the Karaites said, when it says in the Torah, don't light a fire in your house on Shabbat, you know what they felt that meant? That meant don't have a fire burning. So you know what? In a Karaite house, when it's time for candle, for almost time for Shabbat, the man comes in and he says, honey, did you blow out the candles yet? It's almost time for Shabbat. So she would blow out the candles, make a wish, and it'll be Shabbat. And then have cold food, sit in the dark, and freeze. Okay. It's not very popular, but that's what they do. So now, Jews who believed in the oral law, what did we do? We developed a dish that if you eat it, proves you believe in the oral law. How does it prove it? If you have hot food Friday night, does it prove anything? Maybe it was hot from before Shabbat. If I have hot food Shabbat lunchtime, what does it prove? It proves that I believe in the oral law. So well before marijuana, right, the ultimate protest food was cholent. Or Oshia. Right? People would say, hey, dude, they've got some chilled cholent here, man. Right? And this would be the ultimate protest food. So therefore, the written Torah is inscribed on stone and on parchment. But the oral Torah is inscribed on our minds, on our hearts, and in this case also on our arteries. And that's it for this evening. Thank you very much.